Are pillows a feminist issue? According to the modernist poet, artist, designer and valiant feminist Mina Loy, who was not at all qualified to say so but applied her brilliant mind to many things in her long career, it's very bad for your spine to sleep with a pillow. She was particularly worried that older women might be pillow addicts, as she called those comfort seekers. Here at least she was partly right. Curvature of the spine is more prevalent in postmenopausal women. Loy's answer in 1941 was a special corset for figure maintenance and correction called My Lady's Corselet. Attempting to sell her invention to a manufacturer or perhaps a department store buyer, as she frequently did during the 1940s, she described and drew changes in the female body after middle age. In her before and after sketches, poker-backed, tummy-tucked youthfulness becomes slouching curves, which have, outrageously, been allowed to wander at their own sweet will. Loy's solution, a corset made of strong but comfortable netting that would strap two corrective cushions to the spine at night, resisting the movement of that willful, ageing figure. She claimed, optimistically, that her invention would train the skeleton to set to a semblance of youthful formation. Loy's design belongs in a long and vexed history of reshaping the female body. It is vaguely medical. Orthopaedic corsets to correct spinal damage or distortion have been around since at least the 16th century and are still used today. But My Lady's Corselet lies more firmly in the gendered realm of figure improvement. It's part silhouette-shaping underwear like the traditional corset, and latterly Kim Kardashian's so-called waist trainer, or even the control knickers the rest of us might have buried in our drawers. And it's part body contouring, distantly related to today's practice of removing fat to re-sculpt the shape of the body. In fact, this blurriness between beauty and correction, between augmentation and repair, is a feature of the corset as a garment throughout its history. Since their emergence in the early 1500s, corsets have been worn by women to change the shape of their bodies to meet beauty ideals, notably a slim waist, but also to visually correct perceived defects, offer ostensible support for the back, and realign posture. But didn't emancipated women like Mina Loy renounce their corsets in protest at these artificial ideals of the perfect body? Loy, the daughter of a tailor from a middle-class family who cleaved to propriety in what was then the London suburb of Hampstead, had designed her own clothes since her years as an artist in Paris in the early 1900s. She liked natural lines created by fabrics that draped over the body and bold colours. In New York in the 1910s, living amongst the Greenwich Village avant-garde and having published her first poems, she was profiled in the press as the quintessential modern woman. Like her predecessor, the New Woman, this fabled figure was said to have rejected expected ways of dressing along with expected ways of behaving. One article announced Loy's odd-looking draperies and associated her scandalous free verse with her free torso. No rhyme, no meter, no shame. Sensation aside, Loy had written about clothes in her experimental poetry. As she carved out a new feminist way of living, commensurate with new forms of modern art, certain clothes represented values she wanted to leave behind. In her long, sexually bold lyric sequence Songs to Johannes, which imagined uninhibited relations between the sexes, she wrote of silly shoes that restrict her speaker. In one of her satirical illustrations from the same period, a young woman is pinched in at the waist by her corset, while her comparatively huge, ballooning skirt threatens to swallow her up. The figure-correcting corselet, with all its baggage of the youthful, perfect body, seems retrograde in comparison, doesn't it? This, surely, isn't feminist. I'm not so certain. For one thing, that view belongs to an overly simplistic version of fashion history, a narrative in black and white that suggests the artificial corset was rejected in favour of the natural body. This wasn't always the case. As they became more widely fashionable, those sweeping, straighter lines that had characterised bohemian dress like Loy's were achieved for most women through a different kind of corseting. For example, a corset that slimmed the hips rather than focusing on the waist. The S-shaped silhouette achieved by the waist-cinching corset might have been replaced by a more geometric figure from the 1910s. But this required its own kind of body-shaping underwear. The image of freedom presented by those clothes was quite literally underpinned by undergarments. Some type of foundation wear, as it was increasingly called, was used by most women until the 1960s. In any case, The natural as a virtuous state to which women should aspire has been used to reprove and divide women for centuries. In 19th century America, the natural face, unadorned, unbeautified, was synonymous with pure moral character and with racial purity. Naturalness was equated with whiteness. Even the ostensibly artificial world of corsetry came with its own strictures about what was natural and therefore morally correct and what was not. White corsets were good, coloured corsets a sure sign of promiscuity. With all these rules regulating the rights and wrongs of women's dress, I'm loath to apply a new set to Mina Loy's corselet. What if we look at her design in a different way? If we place Loy back in her modernist moment, as an avant-garde poet, artist and designer who disrespected the boundaries between art forms and dreamt of changing the way women could live, we might start to see My Lady's corselet with new eyes. It might instead emerge as a utopian vision for remaking the body aesthetically, a recognition that all bodies are made through what they wear, a refusal of the body you don't want, a claim for bodily autonomy. Loy had form here. In her 1914 feminist manifesto, an excoriating rejection of some feminists' emphasis on equality, Loy calls instead for women to radically shape the world anew, including their bodies. The only solution to the stranglehold of chastity and purity, she shouts in bold, overblown typography, is to surgically destroy virginity. She meant the removal of a woman's hymen. Even allowing for the crude bravado of a manifesto, this is shocking. And problematic. There is a disturbing eugenicist drive to Loy's suggestion that the right kind of woman can be created through biological intervention. But in her extreme vision also lies a refusal of the moral disciplining of women's sexuality, a will to give women the agency to control the story about their bodies. Viewed in this sharp light, her skeleton reshaping corselet is a futuristic apparition. Imagined in mass-manufactured elastic, common in corsets from the 1920s, and a new synthetic material like nylon, as foundation garments increasingly were by the 1940s, let's say it's a technological thought experiment of a woman remade through science, industry, and art. That woman could have been Loy herself. As her own middle age passed, she began to feel depressed about growing old. The trouble with women, she wrote in one letter, is, well, look at me. We don't last. My memory is entirely gone, she sighs, in 1934, aged only 52, and I spent all my life looking for my spectacles. Already she felt a broken-down grandmother who cannot write an English sentence forwards. Suffering the fall from the heights of her reputation, among the New York and European avant-garde in the 1910s and 20s, she writes herself off as a total loss. Everything I touch disappears, she grieves, as if in an elegy for her own life and work. The corselet, or armour for the body, as Loy also called her design, was intended to stave off this kind of loss. It would defend the ageing woman, she hoped, women like her, turning them into hard, immovable and uncompromising forces. And happier ones. There is a deep-rooted feminist argument against this position. It might run along these lines. Fashion, makeup and cosmetic surgery may well allow women to shape themselves, but this self-actualization is illusory. The terms under which they do it are not their own. They don't know what they want, because capitalism and a patriarchal society are dictating all the choices. But what if we don't need to deny the individual woman the possibilities and pleasures of self-transformation in order to take aim at capitalism and its iniquities and the way they affect certain women disproportionately? Our feminist critique can be turned in another direction. In the 1940s, Mina Loy was writing poetry that did just that. By now, the Second World War had dispersed the European avant-garde. Loy was back in New York, living off the Bowery with her youngest daughter. Poor, but always inventive, she was making collaged paintings from recycled materials and trying to make money by designing commercial items like the corselet. She was also walking the streets, observing and spending time with the workers and the destitute of Manhattan's Lower East Side. In response, she wrote a series of poems in which the low-waged and unemployed are noticed and honoured. Her focus in several of the poems are the shoppers and the garment workers of the district, mostly women. The Lower East Side had been the centre of New York's clothing industry. And even when new factories opened uptown, the largely immigrant workforce who had once predominantly made clothes at home still lived in the area south of 14th Street and east of Broadway. Loy enjoyed the image of them going to and from work in the streetcars. Writing about this neighbourhood steeped in clothes past and present, she is sharp-sighted about the conditions of mass production and consumption, which keep wages low and support a class hierarchy between those who make and those who can afford to buy. But Loy never refuses these women, workers or shoppers, the joys of clothes, or the new self they seem to promise. The ageing figure of a poem called Chiffon Velour is out of fashion. She is at rest against the cornerstone of a department store. It might be Auerbach's on 14th Street and Union Square. This spot, Loy insists of the woman, is hers alone to model the last creation, original design of destitution. The woman's black skirt glows as a soiled mirror, reflects the gutter, a yard of chiffon velour. Critical of the system that leaves this woman in the gutter, Loy reserves her right to create something else, something glowing from her conditions. How should I, a feminist, approach Loy's corselet then? I could observe that today's catastrophic pollution of the world's oceans with microfibers from synthetic clothes reaches back here to the plastics that revolutionised women's wear. I could recognise the imperialist interests and exploited labour involved in extracting latex from rubber trees from which elastic was made. And I could learn lessons from the strongly unionised, women and immigrant-dominated garment industry of early 20th century America, when fair pay and working conditions were protected. The fashion industry then and now should be subjected to difficult questions about its social and environmental responsibilities. These are feminist issues. But I'd like to allow those who are getting dressed to imagine new bodies, new versions of themselves every day. Or in bed at night, with no pillow, dreaming that my lady's corselet is working its magic.